Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. And I've been doing this show now for, I don't know, nearly 30 years, somewhere in there. And every year I've interviewed the president, the current president. It's a one-year term of the American Veterinary Medical Association. This guy I've talked to before, his name is Dr. Michael Bailey, and he is especially articulate. So I am very much looking forward to this conversation with Dr. Bailey, who travels now as president of the American Veterinary Medical Association. Dr. Bailey, essentially, what does that job mean? Which will the answer will take us literally to where you are right now.
Oh, well, what the president does, mainly, we are the vocal spokesperson for the American Veterinary Medical Association, which means that we are the visible spokesperson for over 108,000 veterinarians in the United States. And we also do a fairly good job of trying to represent our colleagues around the world also. As to where I am today, I am at the World Small Animal Veterinary Association meeting in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil.
That is so cool, you know. And I've been to the WASAVA meeting myself. I've presented at that meeting. It's been several years, and I am jealous that you are where you happen to be. But it's important to understand that part of your job is really as a kind of ambassador, is that a good word, to describe, not only to represent veterinarians in general, which we're about to do, to the general public, but also to the profession in the United States and around the globe.
Yes, a big part of what the president and the AVMA does of the American Veterinary Medical Association is we represent not just our profession and our colleagues, but also make sure that we have a good understanding of what the general public needs from us, understands from us, and maybe does not understand from us so that we can do a better job of trying to communicate that.
All right, that's the perfect lead-in for this topic, access to care. At veterinary meetings, it's brought up very frequently. Here's the thing. We have more pets, statistically, not only in America, but as it happens in many nations around the world, than ever before. People are more bonded with their pets as family members more than ever before. In fact, I just did a very bad thing. I call them pets because a lot of people, and I understand, call their pets fur babies. And in fact, for many individuals, their pet is their baby. They will do anything they can for their pet. Now, that's all fact, and that's one side of the coin. But there's another side of the coin, Dr. Bailey, as well, and that is affordability of care. Veterinary costs have gone up. In fact, they've gone up higher or more quickly in many cases than the cost of inflation has even gone up. So there is a price to be paid that some people just can't pay, particularly since also another data point is there are more multi-pet homes than ever before. So maybe you would have been able to deal with this with two pets, but not necessarily three or four pets. And in fact, one of the repercussions of what I'm describing is shelter numbers are up and that more people are giving up their pets for a variety of reasons, but arguably this is one, to animal shelters, at least in some places, including Chicago, than in recent history. So with all that as a backdrop, I'll let you comment.
Boy, that was a big entrance into discussing this. So access to care, let's start there. Our desire is that everybody who has access to a furry family member is able to have the care that they need. But we also have to make sure that everybody understands that veterinarians aren't just responsible for their furry family members, but they're also responsible for food security and many public health issues, including the bumblebee. So veterinarians have a very wide scope. So part of that access to care is, do we have enough veterinarians to cover all of that territory? Overall, depending on where you live, access to a veterinarian may or may not be an issue. And I'm putting it that way because it does come down to geography. If you're in a suburb, you probably can go around a corner or two and find a veterinarian that can give you care. If you live in the rural area or if you're in the inner city, that may be a different story. There are ways of getting access, but let's first talk about why you even want to have a veterinarian to give care to your fur babies. Everybody wants to be healthy. Everybody wants to have a long life. And we know that having regular checkups, so yes, visiting your veterinarian, and having those vaccinations, which everybody's talking about in the news, some positive, less positive, vaccinations do extend the life of individuals. I'm putting it that way because it's not just veterinary patients, in other words, your fur baby, but it's also human health. Vaccines have extended human health lifespan and your pet's health span. So vaccines overall are good. Does that mean that there cannot be some adverse reactions, usually minor adverse reactions? Every time you introduce something into your body, you can introduce water into your body and have an adverse reaction depending on how you do it.
All right. So
overall, vaccines are extremely good. Go on.
No, I was just going to say, I do want to talk separately about vaccines. But before we lose the train of thought, what about the cost of veterinary care and the fact that some people are just saying, you know what, I can't afford it. Or I can, but not for multiple pets.
Well, Steve, I'm not going to let you get off that easily because the discussion about vaccines actually is part of the discussion about cost of veterinary care. If your pet is properly taken care of, that includes vaccines, you will decrease the cost of care over that pet's life. Now, let's get to where I think you specifically want to get to, and that is the fact that the cost of veterinary care has gone up. But, you know, we can't really focus it that narrowly because the cost of health care has gone up and veterinary costs are directly related back to the cost of overall health care. The materials we use, the equipment we use in veterinary medicine are the exact same materials and equipment that's used in human health care. So as human health care goes up, veterinary health care goes up. But for many people, they do not see the substantial increase in cost of human health care because they have third-party payer, in other words, insurance. Only 3% of veterinary patients have insurance. So that's part of the difference right there. The other thing comes down to the technology that is applied to veterinary patients today is, once again, the exact same technology that you can get in human health care. So that means MRIs, which were not available in veterinary health care 20 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago, you can fairly easily get access to it depending on your locality. So technology costs money, and that goes up.
And I want to
other factors.
I want to jump in there only because we have to break. But when we come back, I want to talk further about access to care and everything you're talking about. And you brought up vaccines, and I have something to say about that and lots to ask you about because, as you point out, it has certainly been in the news. President of the American Veterinary Medical Association, Dr. Michael Bailey, is here, and we'll be right back. Dr. Michael Bailey is here on WGN. He is, of course, the president of the American Veterinary Medical Association. Dr. Bailey, we're talking about a very serious topic here, access to care and affordability of veterinary care. And, you know, what you point out is something, here's how I say it. Unfortunately, cancer occurs in our pets, and unfortunately, of course, it occurs in people. And the same cancers sometimes do occur as well. And the treatment is, or at least it can be, absolutely identical. Yet the cost for veterinary treatment can be, I'm making up a number at the moment just to make a point, if you're talking about surgery and chemotherapy and a couple of visits to the veterinarian, et cetera, it can add up to $10,000 over the course of, say, nearly a year. In human medicine, we're talking about at least well over $1 million. And it's the same exact thing. So in a sense, it's a great bargain. But it's not a bargain if you simply can't afford the money, Dr. Bailey.
Right. You're bringing up a very good point there. And whereas veterinary care is in the, let's say, hundreds or tens of thousands of dollars compared to millions in human medicine, it's still, it's a matter of what your family can afford. So I want to go back to the fact that if you do things to try and reduce the diseases in the long run, then you can probably reduce the cost of overall veterinary health care. But insurance, which very few people have for their pets, is one of the ways to try and mitigate that. Because if you have insurance, there's going to be somebody to help you pay for that veterinary health care. Now, as we also are having better health care for our pets, remember, they're living longer. So those chronic diseases like cancer, like diabetes, are going to be more likely to show up because our pets are having a longer lifespan. And those same diseases we see in ourselves, we're going to see in our pets as their lifespan is extended.
And to an extent, this does tie into what we're talking about, and that is so-called vaccine hesitancy, which has been in the news. So according to a recent study, about 75% of pet owners trust their veterinarian's opinion about vaccine recommendations. I think that's great, except that means about 25% of pet parents, still millions of people, say we don't necessarily trust. And what really shocked me, and I'm not even sure that you're aware of this or not, that there are concerns. So the good news, one more thing, the good news is that people in some cases that are hesitant themselves to say take a COVID vaccine or whatever will listen, maybe not to their doctor, unfortunately perhaps, but will listen to their veterinarian when it comes to their pet care. So that's one side of the coin that's really, I think, interesting. The other side of that coin, though, is that there is a significant percent that feel veterinarians still want to get rich, quote-unquote, pushing vaccines, and don't understand what I'm about to say that you can comment on, that veterinarians, first of all, do not get rich off vaccines. That's a fact. But secondly, if they are to get rich, they would do better financially by treating all of those pets for which the vaccine could prevent an illness. So treating those illnesses certainly adds up to a lot more dollars than vaccinating. Can you comment on this?
Well, from the point of view, if we wanted to make money, you're right. Having our pets, our patients, because that's really what we're talking about, be sick, we would earn a whole lot money, more money than trying to prevent illness. Veterinarians are not in this business to get rich. And to be honest, most of us have so much student debt that if we were trying to get rich, we would find another profession to do it in. Vaccine hesitancy. First thing I do want to say is I can understand why there's some individuals hesitant. I can understand that they want to have education. The best way to get educated is to go in and talk to your veterinarian about what your concerns are. They can educate you to the specific vaccines, and they can even tailor a vaccine protocol to your pet, because vaccines that may be needed in one part of the country or one part of the world may not be needed in another part of the country or another part of the world. So we can tailor these to the specific pet and to the specific location. We're not just going to push vaccines just because we got to get them out of our refrigerator and into the pet. It's what is ever needed. Talk to your veterinarian. And you can get on avma.org, and there's more information on there for education also. But most importantly, vaccines have been shown to extend people's and pets' lives. And if you do not have those vaccines, I'm sorry, there is going to be a significant impact. There will be an increase in adverse reactions from not being vaccinated in anybody who we're talking about. Steve, am I answering your question?
You are. And another example is that recently, I think it was in Texas, There was kind of a celebration several years ago. Oh, no more distemper. And then for various reasons having to do with politics in some cases, people stopped vaccinating puppies for distemper. And then guess what? There's distemper that blew up in the community. So there is. Are you worried that if people don't vaccinate, we are simply going to see things like distemper that if they don't go away, at least their level has been minimized in many places in the country. We're going to see that pop up. And the worst thing that can happen, I suppose, would be rabies occurring at numbers that are larger than they are if people don't vaccinate for rabies, which is the law in all 50 states.
Well, Steve, you just stole my thunder because I was going to bring up rabies. Let's talk about that. Rabies, canine rabies, has been eliminated from the United States. There are still other kinds of rabies and other species, but the specific kind of canine rabies, which is most significant to us, has been eliminated. But if we do not vaccinate for rabies, it will return. But as I say, canine rabies, you have to realize the reason we vaccinate our dogs and our cats, yes, it's to protect them, but most importantly, it's to protect the people in the households that our fur babies live in. That's why we vaccinate them. It's to protect human health. And if we were to stop vaccinating for, let's just talk about rabies, I'm sorry, the number of cases will go up, canine rabies will return to the United States, and people are going to be exposed. In the United States last year, there were two cases of rabies, not canine rabies, but another kind of rabies. Around the world, 53,000 people died from rabies. And realize, once you start showing clinical signs to rabies, it is, I'm going to say, nearly 100% fatal.
Yep. All true. I'm giving Dr. Bailey a tough time here, asking tough questions. I'll continue to do that because I'm curious about another hot topic, about autism or humans being on the spectrum. I wonder if our pets can be. And also, I want to offer a warning that is true for pets regarding Tylenol. And we will do that and also talk about virtual care when we come back with Dr. Michael Bailey on WGN. We've talked with Dr. Bailey about this a little bit, but I want to go to this topic a little more in depth because so many people have asked me about this. Can dogs or cats be on the spectrum, have autistic spectrum disorder? Well, it used to be that the answer was no, but now the answer is probably no. In recent years, professionals have begun to label some pets, dogs more than cats, as being on the spectrum and having neurodevelopmental conditions. But you know what? The traits generally can be explained in animals. For example, individuals who are socially aloof, have difficulty with routine social interactions, they can be explained often by a lack of nutrition in utero or a lack of socialization or both. Lack of socialization as a puppy or kitten. And the same may be true for individual pets that don't want to be touched. So are they truly on the spectrum? They may have a neurological issue, but is that autistic spectrum disorder? I don't know. Nobody does for sure, but it's thought probably not. Some believe that dogs with neurological behaviors like tail chasing or snapping at non-existent flies could be a sign of being on the spectrum. Behaviors that look similar to humans having autistic spectrum disorder, behaviors like repetitive movements, fixations, social withdrawals, etc. But in dogs, some of this can be explained. There are breed predispositions for it, but even if that's true, some may argue, well, the breed is predisposed, but are they predisposed to actually being on the spectrum? I don't know the answer to that, but probably not. It is thought that, well, for example, a border collie, typical breed that may chase flies that aren't there or chase its tail. But when the dog is a herding dog and given a job to do, scientific studies have shown less of those behaviors turn out to happen. Now, if the answer was yes, that dogs and cats could actually be on the spectrum, potentially, if that were the case in pets, it's definitely not caused by Tylenol, acetaminophen. And I mention that only because, not only for fun, for a couple of reasons. First of all, so many of the explanations for disorders in dogs are identical, and to an extent in cats, are identical as in people. So if Tylenol were causing this in people, it could be that the same would be true in dogs and cats, except that if the cat has Tylenol, the cat dies. So we don't see any behavior. That's right. That's how toxic Tylenol is for cats. And for dogs, yeah, they can tolerate it, but very low doses. It's not recommended. So Tylenol, for at least dogs and cats, does not explain autistic spectrum disorders. He is the president of the American Veterinary Medical Association, based right here in Schaumburg, Dr. Michael Bailey. Dr. Bailey, I said we would talk about, and this seems like, what? What are we talking about? I remember years ago, I received many questions, you know, about autism and whether our dogs or cats could be on the spectrum. It was thought that behaviors like tail chasing and some other things might be an example of this. Well, the answer was no, but it's not so easy anymore. I think some experts, I know some experts, have changed their opinions about all this. There is no definitive test in veterinary medicine to determine whether a pet can be on the spectrum or not. So in a sense, what I'm about to ask you is an opinion question, but do you think our pets can be on the spectrum?
Being a veterinarian means I'm a scientist. And as we look at scientific literature, there is no peer-reviewed scientific literature that supports autism in veterinary medicine. I will also go a little bit further. There is no peer-reviewed literature that supports the causation of autism connected with vaccines. I'm not saying that there aren't articles out there, but they're not peer-reviewed scientific articles. So I would have to say, being that I'm not a neurologist, and the neurologists I have asked have told me the same thing, we do not have autism in veterinary medicine that we know of. Now, the things that you're describing, tail chasing and some other disorders, mind you, our pets do have neurologic disorders. They also have, boredom. A lot of the things that people see and say, oh, could that be autism, is probably because we're not giving our pets enough stimulation in the right way. So we do need to realize that our pets are intelligent, sentient beings that we need to be sure that they have proper stimulation so that they do feel as if they have a useful life in front of them.
Now, if the answer were to be yes, that our pets, and I'm not suggesting it is yes either, but if it were to be yes, and by the way, let me back up and explain some of what you're right. We can explain some of these issues as neurologic but / behavioral. And if we make adjustments in their lifestyle, in other words, an extreme example, if you will, is give a border collie a job as they were bred to do, then we're going to see with the border collie, actually, some of these behaviors, in some cases anyway, completely disappear. And also, we know that breed predisposition has something to do with explaining these behaviors rather than the animal having a neurological disorder explained as being on the spectrum, autism spectrum disorder. But having said that, if the answer was yes, and dogs and cats actually have autism spectrum disorder, the cause cannot be Tylenol. Because Tylenol, and I think this is important as a side note so people don't make a mistake, Tylenol is toxic to pets, correct?
Yes, it is, but I need to put a caveat in there. And that may sound a little strange, what I'm about to say. Do not give Tylenol to your cats. No ifs, ands, or buts. That's one statement. Dogs can benefit from low levels of Tylenol, but I would say it should only be prescribed by your veterinarian at the dose which they feel is appropriate for the period of time they feel it's appropriate. But please keep it away from your cats and only administer it to your dogs on a veterinarian's orders.
Makes perfect sense.
And yes,
yeah,
it has no known effect on autism in our veterinary patients I'm not an MD, so I can't talk about human patients. But from what I'm reading, it probably doesn't vary either. But that's just from what I'm reading.
Fair enough. All right. I want to talk about the convenience. So during this thing that was the pandemic, we would go online to speak to our own physicians, to speak to our friends and relatives, and also to speak to our veterinarian. And that still exists, virtual care. So is virtual care a good thing, or is it not such a good thing, Dr. Bailey?
I think it can be used to great advantage, but we need to define it a little bit. So we're talking about telehealth, which covers all of the aspects of virtual care. And then we're talking about telemedicine, teletriage, teleadvice. There's all different levels in through there. Telehealth can extend that access to care. Steve, did you intentionally bring me back to the beginning of the conversation?
a little bit.
It can extend that access to care. We do have to be careful, because what we're trying to inform people is that hands-on examination is more than beneficial. Sometimes it can make the difference between having an accurate diagnosis and a grossly inaccurate diagnosis. So while we support telehealth and the many levels that involve there, we do recommend that a physical client-patient relationship be established with your veterinarian. Now, realize, depending on your state, so I want to be sure we understand that every state has different rules. Depending on your state, a physical VCPR, veterinary client-patient relationship, only has to theoretically be established once a year. So if you go in and see your veterinarian once a year, they can talk all the telehealth, depending on the state and the aspects of it, that they want with you. If you have not seen your veterinarian, let's say in the last 2 or 5 years, there is going to be some hesitancy. And depending on the state, it may not be able to be established that way. Now, teletriage or teleadvice, there's very few states that restrict. I don't know of any states that do, but I want to be sure I don't know all the state laws. And that means, can I call the veterinarian and say, this is what I'm seeing, should I take it into a veterinarian? That's teleadvice. They say, yeah, you should go in and see a veterinarian. Teletriage may be my dog just, or my cat just ate a whole bunch of Tylenol, and they may say, here's how you induce vomiting, and after you've done that, take it into an urgent care or emergency center, because that can be deadly to that cat. That's teletriage. But as far as prescribing medication, let's say 2 weeks worth of antibiotics, that is going to be governed by your state. In some states, all you can call in and they can prescribe it over the phone without ever having to see you for non-controlled substances. In some states, can't. So I'm being careful here because I don't want to step on a state's rights prerogative. Can it help? Yes. Should we be practicing telehealth with our veterinary patients? Absolutely, because it does extend access to care. But realize we have to work within regulations, and if we haven't seen that pet recently, we cannot do a full assessment just over a telephone or even on a FaceTime call. We need to see them for various reasons for a complete examination.
And I want to talk about what some of those reasons are, talk a little bit more about telehealth. And dog training methods have been in the news as well. I'm curious as to what your take on that is. American Veterinary Medical Association President Dr. Michael Bailey will be back on WGN next. Dr. Michael Bailey, President of the American Veterinary Medical Association. I hope I'm not giving you too tough a time here, but I'm bringing up topics that people, I think, Dr. Bailey, if you were to stop people on the street, this is the kind of thing that I think they want to talk about and hear from you with your opinions about. So you said that, all right, it's been, say, 2 or 3 years since I've seen my veterinarian, and the state says, you know, it should be every year if you're going to do a telehealth call with your veterinarian. And here's what I know you would bring out is that, okay, 2 years, that doesn't seem like a long time, but for a pet, that can be, depending on whether we're talking about a dog or a cat or another kind of pet and the age of that animal, but that could be like 6 years or more easily in human years. And imagine contacting your doctor out of the blue who you haven't seen in 6, 7, or 8 years or more, you know? So I think that that, to me anyway, Dr. Bailey, makes sense.
Well, let's take it a little bit more granular and back to the human species. Remember, humans are animals also. I'm saying that with the greatest bit of respect there. Imagine you were born today and you saw the doctor today, but when you were 2 years of age, you had not seen a doctor again. Just think about all the changes that that baby has gone through in that 2 years of age. Our pets are going through just as rapid a change as they are. So we have to realize part of the reason of doing this is because organisms, people and animals, do change rapidly. Once you, let's say, get up to 18 or 20 in human, you may not be making as rapid a change, but your pet is still making a rapid change from 2 years to 4 years to 6 years. There you're going from neonate to middle age to old age in some particular breeds. So there's a lot of things we need to assess. We need to be able to look in their eyes. We need to be able to palpate their abdomens. All these things. One of the reasons healthcare prices are going up is because we're depending a lot on technology. But the senses that were given to us by whoever you believe the creator are, believe me or not, are some of the greatest medical tools that people have.
Well said. So let's say, and this is the real world, that you purchase a car. And this is actually true. And with that car, as an incentive to purchase that car, you're given a list of things. You get to go to the hot dog place down the street for 6 months and get a free hot dog. You have an opportunity to come in and get free popcorn whenever you have your car repaired. Oh, and by the way, you get this company as free online advice about your pet. Now, so you call, and you're actually talking to a veterinary professional who, first of all, may not be in your state, and you'll explain why that's a problem, may not even be in America, actually, and you can explain why that's an issue. But most importantly, in my view, they have no records of your pet. They don't know you, really, and they certainly don't know your pet's history. Now, as a pet parent, you can think about what you can think about. You can describe the best you can what that history is, but we're not veterinarians necessarily, and we also don't always have the best memories. And it's like seeing the forest from the trees, or however that expression goes, it's our pet. So because it's our pet, are we describing and remembering everything correctly? And even if we do, we're not going to remember every little bit of blood work that may be very, very significant, that the kidney levels have changed or whatever it might be. So talking to that third party that says, I'm going to provide virtual veterinary care, to me, can be problematic. I'm curious as to how you feel.
Okay, let's take that even a more granular again. Boy, I'm doing this to you today.
That's okay.
Imagine they say it's veterinary care, but how do you even know that you're talking to a veterinarian? They say it's veterinary care. You don't even know you're talking to a veterinarian. For all you know, you could be talking to somebody who is an auto mechanic, excellent at fixing cars or motorcycles, but they may not know anything about your dog, cat, horse, guinea pig. How about the fish in your aquarium? So we want to be sure that there's somebody that has qualifications. Then it comes down to you could be talking to artificial intelligence. And artificial intelligence is extremely good at telling you what it thinks you want to know. And believe me, I'm an advocate of artificial intelligence, but if anybody has never heard this term before, look up hallucinations and artificial intelligence. What hallucination with artificial intelligence is, it means it can sound so real, it's sort of like a 14-year-old telling a lie. You don't know whether they're telling the truth or not. You need to be able to know who it is you're talking to, and can you get in contact with that person or AI entity the next time you have a problem, or when you find out that they prescribe Tylenol to your cat. You need somebody who's keeping records. So they're keeping track of all that blood work, all the weight gains, all the teeth that may have been examined or have to be removed? What was the last day you had dental care? By having a veterinarian who you go to regularly, and we're not talking about whether they're practicing telehealth or not, but just somebody who can keep track of your pet's medical records, they can look back and say, oh, I see you had all your vaccinations here. We don't need to give you any today. Don't you want to have somebody who's helping you keep track so your life becomes simpler and your life and the life of your pet is extended? And I'm going to go back to this. Remember, veterinary care is human health care also. So if you skimp on veterinary care, how is that going to affect human health care? I'm going to give you an example. Leptospirosis is an important disease that we see in animals, but people can get leptospirosis. There are vaccines to prevent it in your dog and your cat. But if you're exposed to it, you want to know where you were exposed to it, and you want to be sure you've eliminated it from your household pets, just as one example.
And that's actually a very timely example for us right here in Chicago, considered the number one rat city. So if your dog is not protected, a rat who is infected, and lots of rats are, can piddle in a puddle. Your dog can walk in that puddle, lick the paw. And if your dog is not protected by that vaccine, your dog can get leptospirosis. And some dogs are asymptomatic, which is wonderful. They don't get sick, but you can get sick not even knowing in many cases that your dog is infected. We have literally 1 minute left here. So very quickly, in the dog training world, it seems that shock collars or e-collars have made a comeback. In 30 seconds, your personal opinion on using that sort of device to train our dogs.
Well, I'm not a fan about going to shock collars or any adverse training method, particularly initially, but I don't want to come down and say stay absolutely away from. Sometimes that's what you need to modify the behavior so that pet can be safe and responsive. Then if that's the ultimate extreme, if it's a choice between that and euthanizing the pet, I would say, okay, let's do it. But in most cases, they need to be used in a humane fashion, making sure the pet knows why it's receiving that shock, making sure that it's an intelligent training method that's going on. And many times the shocks are used very infrequently, just enough so the pets know when they hear a sound there could be a shock. And then what's followed is just the sound, because the pet has already been conditioned to the fact that sound is associated with a shock, so they're going to stop doing that negative behavior. And we don't want there to be a negative behavior. We don't want anybody bitten by a pet because it may be excessively aggressive. And we don't want that pet running out in the middle of a road. So that's why I'm saying, whereas I would rather not be done, we have to remember that sometimes we need to do some things that are felt a little bit unpalatable so that we can protect our pets from the adverse reactions they may experience in other ways.
Well, we don't.
I hope that was it.
Well, we don't exactly agree on that, but that's okay, because you are the president of the American Veterinary Medical Association. Lots of what we spoke about available at avma.org. Dr. Michael Bailey, thank you so much. Check it out. It's all there at wgnradio.com. The past shows, all the shows on WGN, really, but including the pet shows at WGNradio.com. So, for example, if you missed it, Jill Rappaport, remember her from the Today Show, entertainment reporter? But when there was a report about pets, it was Jill Rappaport offering that report. So I spoke to her a couple of weeks ago about the Gray Muzzle Organization, about the need to care for and get the older, the senior pets, which are most dogs actually in shelters are older dogs, and to get them adopted. We talked about the joy of adopting older animals. And also Dr. Teresa DePorter. You can find that also at WGNradio.com. We talked about everything from fish to pheromones and also dog training methods. All of that once again at WGNradio.com. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early on WGN.